Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Our next guests are two of the nation's most distinguished scholars of Thomas Jefferson. Annette Gordon-Reed is a Harvard professor and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer who wrote The Definitive History of Sally Hemings and Her Family. She's the enslaved woman with whom Jefferson had a long-term relationship. Peter Onuf is professor emeritus at the University of Virginia, which Jefferson founded, and senior fellow at Monticello's International Center for Jefferson Studies. Now, these are interesting times for the founding fathers. We're in the midst of a wholesale rethink of their legacies as they relate to slavery, especially on American campuses. It's true, of course, of Jefferson as well, author of the Declaration of Independence and slave owner. As Gordon-Reed and Onuf write in their book, it is impossible to understand 18th and 19th century America and the country the United States has become without grappling with Jefferson and his legacy. And they do so in their new book. It's called Most Blessed of Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. Annette Gordon-Reed and Peter Onuf join us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
So first of all, let me just ask you, what made you two decide to come together to write this book? Because you both have such individual renowned histories of your own regarding Jefferson.
Well, we've been friends since the mid-1990s when my first book came out, and we've been engaged in a very long conversation about Jefferson. And as Peter was thinking about retiring, I thought we should...
She wouldn't let me.
Just one last time to come together and to sort of put down on paper a lot of the things that we've been discussing over the past couple of decades. So it just seemed like a natural thing to do.
I mean, Jefferson is one of the most written about founding fathers already. So what aspect of him, the man, was left to discover other than maybe all of him?
Well, the first thing to say is that all Jefferson scholars are not created equal. We have different expertise, and our pair of expertise brought together, we think, offers a fresh perspective. Here's the short answer to your question. We think that the false distinction between Jefferson's public life and the things he said, as in the Declaration of Independence, and his private life, that's a false distinction. We're trying to put Jefferson back together again to show how his ideas grow out of his life experiences.
And we're also trying to move the discussion beyond fixating on hypocrisy, which is a usual thing you do now. It's a sort of a shutdown word that keeps people from actually thinking about Jefferson, I think, we think, in a productive kind of way.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to move the ball a little bit further down the field than we've been stuck for the past couple of decades.
Well, so I want to come back to this notion about how we see him today in just a moment. But let's first of all uncover or explore a little bit of what you write in the book. I mean, the subtitle of the book is Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. The title, though, itself, Most Blessed of Patriarchs, that comes from a letter that Jefferson himself wrote in, what, 1793?
Right.
Yes. Doesn't it seem a little strange to you that the great icon of democracy would call himself
a patriarch?
A patriarch, yeah. We thought that was striking, and we thought that was an opening to take a closer look at Jefferson. Why would he say that? This is in the midst of a career devoted to the Republican experiment that's going to change the world, and he seems to be glorying in the fact that he is the lord of his domain, and he has control over everything and everybody there. That seems like a big disconnect. So rather than talk about hypocrisy, let's talk about how those two things work together.
Because he thought they worked together. And so a lot of the book is trying to say, in essence, it's not what we think Jefferson ought to be doing, but what he thought he was doing in the world and how things made sense to him.
Okay, so when he used the word patriarch, in his mind, what form of patriarchy was he thinking about? Because this was vis-a-vis, he was writing about returning to Monticello, right?
Mm-hmm. Antediluvian.
Yes,
right?
he uses that phrase in another letter to someone. So we know that this is not just a one-off. This is really something about his understanding of how he is living. He is in control of 5,000 acres of land, a couple of hundred enslaved people, a white family. As the male, he is the head of the family. And he's thinking about the privileges that he has, but he also is thinking about responsibilities that he has to people. So it's the whole ball of wax there. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very large sense of, and I think I would have to say, a very realistic sense of the power relations that existed between him and other people.
Realistic.
Yeah, okay. Realistic in the sense that, you know, he was in control of things, or he could make people.
You're probably not old enough to remember when men were supposed to dominate, when patriarchy was thought to be natural.
Some would say the era has not come to an end yet.
Well, nature is a key word for Jefferson. And what we know as a socially constructed relationship, the way families are organized and have been organized, we see it changing in our own lifetime. So it's demystified. It's no longer natural. But in Jefferson's day, the idea of the father's domination over his family is a given. And Republican government, his great gift to us, he would like to think, is based on his understanding of what nature enjoins, what nature requires. And so this is where we stop. We say, well, hold it. We don't think that's natural. We do think all men are created equal. And for us, then, there's a problem. But that didn't exist for Jefferson at this time.
Well, the problem, the sense of hypocrisy, comes out of our own questions. And they're legitimate questions, but it's more about us than it really is about the way he is seeing the world.
I guess this brings forward the question that I was going to come to a little bit later, because we see it as hypocrisy now. Perhaps another word, or some people see it, another word may be contradiction. Yeah. But was he a contradiction even in his own time? Because many people would point to George Washington, who in his will emancipated his slaves.
He had to be dead first, of course, you understand.
But Jefferson did not do that for his own slaves, except for the children he had with Sally Hemings.
Yes, and some of their relatives. Well, Washington is an interesting case. When he died and provided for the emancipation of slaves upon Martha's death, there were some people who thought that that was sort of a cop-out, that he would have... He had enormous political capital, and he spent none of it on the issue of slavery while he was alive. The children, he had no children of his own. He had stepchildren whom he loved, but he also knew that they were part of the Custis family and that the slaves that Martha owned would come to them. So it's not a question of somebody. Jefferson was broke when he died, and there was no family coming to ride to the rescue of his legal white daughter when he died. I'm glad Washington freed his slaves, but if you look at the situation, he knew that they were going to have slaves even after Martha died, because she had dower slaves from her previous husband. The Custis family was extremely wealthy. They would be well taken care of.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's easy to do
in
that situation.
And it's important to keep in mind that Jefferson did know that slavery was unjust, and he had a solution. It's not a solution that we recognize as legitimate. It was never going to happen. But it was, we need to emancipate the enslaved people, and that has to be a collective decision of the slave-owning class, that is, white Virginians. It's their country, he thinks. And that decision would be emancipate and expatriate, send people away to a country of their own. This, the unfriendly word for this is deportation, or we might even think of things like genocide. It's horrible. But for Jefferson, it's
doing
justice.
Well, I wouldn't say genocide. Black people can live without white people.
yeah, exactly right. Yeah. But the idea is that, and this is a wonderful phrase from his Notes on the State of Virginia, his only book. He says in his plan for emancipation, we will send them someplace, it would turn out, maybe Africa. And we would, that is the white people, the people who had votes, the citizens, the legislators of Virginia, would declare them a free and independent people, which is a wonderful reversal of the declaration that Jefferson is so famous for writing. And the active agents of that quest for independence would be whites, not blacks, because, of course, the danger was that there would be a servile insurrection. We don't want to encourage that sort of thing. That's why we have to keep the peoples apart.
There would be a race war.
Yeah.
If you emancipated blacks, you know, Peter's exactly right. If you emancipated blacks without expatriation, there would be conflict, and there would, you know, they couldn't live together in peace, and eventually there would be a race war.
Yeah.
And I often say scoff at that, but you look at what has happened.
How well have we done?
And what have we done since then? I mean, we've had tremendous conflicts from then until now, even though we reject his solution.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about the way in which the truth of slavery really did, I mean, you point this out in the book, it actually touched Jefferson's life. And obviously, he had his slave owning had an impact on many other lives from birth, from cradle to grave. I mean,
yes.
I was astonished to see that he said his earliest memory was being handed up to a slave from a pillow. And of course, the last words he ever spoke on his deathbed were heard by one of his slaves. Yes. Monticello itself built with slave labor.
Yes. I mean, this was the society that he lived in. And It's not by way of excuse, but it's very, very difficult for people to walk away from all that they know, because it wasn't just about money. It wasn't even primarily about money. Most of the people at Monticello are building the house. I mean, they're not doing things that are terribly productive. I mean, that was not an obsession with him. But if you think about what enslaved people meant to his affective life, to his sense of himself. I mean, obviously, he's there with a. I mean, he marries a woman who brings to his family six half brothers and sisters who are enslaved. So his view of himself as a slave owner are just, you know, are tied up in this idea of how he deals with them. He sees himself as a quote unquote good slave owner, because the people that he knows are around him are his family members, really.
And this is the tension or contradiction that you're getting at. And that is between what happens on a day-to-day basis in life at Monticello and his long-term solution. That solution wasn't going to take place tomorrow or even the next day or the next year or the next, maybe it would be the next century. It would be a future generation that would take on this task. And why would they do it? And this is key, I think, to the empire of the imagination. It's because of his vision of progress and improvement. They would be more enlightened. In other words, he's predicting that there will be a change of consciousness that will lead Virginian slave owners to sacrifice this valuable property and do the right thing.
And it's tough for us because we don't have that sense of progress. Yeah. I think we're a much more cynical age. So when you hear him say that, you say, oh, he can't possibly believe that.
We know us.
But I'm curious, though, because what I'm still quite not 100% certain of, and I wonder if you can explain it to me a little more, did Jefferson rest easy with the contradiction that he was experiencing? I mean, like, as you say, he wanted to see progress.
Easier than we think he should. And that's where we get back to patriarchy. And as Annette says, his conception of himself as a good slave owner, he has a kind of a stewardship responsibility until history unfolds and the right thing happens to take care of his people. And this is it. There's an intimacy here. There's a sense of connection that's really important in his domestic world. Mm-hmm.
And that we reject this, but we're thinking, but again, it's not just about what we think about it. It's you thinking about how he's viewing the world. He does think of this as, these are my responsibilities. And we kind of go, when you hear that. But that's what was there.
Right. Well, we're speaking with Annette Gordon-Reed and Peter Onuf. Their new book is Most Blessed of the Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. Trying to take a look at Jefferson, the man, in his in the context of his time. You know, it's really interesting because there's a chapter in the book which I would have never thought would be included in a new investigation or exploration of Jefferson. And you write about Jefferson and music. Can you tell us why this was so important?
Because this was, he described it as the favorite passion of his soul. And this was something that was critical to his sense of self. It's something that brought him joy. It was something that we suggest sort of goes to his system of desire for order and control. It was everywhere to him. He sang all the time, apparently, and had mockingbirds who sang, and his children with Sally, all the sons played the violin, his daughters played the harpsichord. So there's no way, we didn't think we could talk about the character of the man without bringing this particular aspect of him, which, as you say, isn't talked about very much to the fore, because it's always there for him.
There's a social and even political dimension to it,
yes.
I think. To put it bluntly, it's not jazz that he's in favor of. Maybe folk music, because that's his people and it resonates for him. But making music together is, in a way, epitomizes his idea of the good conversation in music, but the good conversations in society that make for harmony and that make for order, as Annette says. It's a model of republican government. We should be making beautiful music together.
And he uses that as a metaphor when he's talking about life in lots of different ways. So it's the actual physical playing of music. When he's in France, he loves, loves being there with the type of music that he can hear that he can't hear in the United States. But as Peter says, he extrapolates from that to sort of everyday life and his vision of government and his vision of the way a community comes together.
I understand that he was even so enraptured with the music that he was concerned about the sound of the oral delivery of the Declaration of Independence.
That is our music, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he scripted it. Or what are music? People write music, they don't script things.
Yeah, we get what you mean. Yeah. We get what you mean.
Well, so let's talk a little bit. I mean, speaking of the Declaration, it's from the mind, the imagination of this man that the Declaration of Independence springs forth, you know, like the founding document of the nation. So tell us a little bit more about sort of what you found vis-a-vis the other sort of hidden recesses of his imagination that help us understand him today.
Other than the Declaration?
Yeah, I mean, because it's this empire of the imagination is the subtitle of the book.
Well, he's thinking about religion. He's thinking about a sort of crafting, as he does, a civic, you know, civil religion for the United States of America, taking the Bible and cutting it up, removing miracles and sort of leaving a document that he thinks will spark the emotions and the imaginations of people to give them a sort of a religion that will be suitable to a Republican government. So he's thinking about all aspects of American life, politics, but he understands that religion will be a part of American life and that that's an important thing. So he creates this text. You know, it's very different than the Declaration, but he creates this text the Bible, the Jefferson Bible for the American people.
So we're nearing the, you know, roughly the end of the conversation. And I just want, I'm wondering, what would be your response to someone today? And there are many people who still would come to you and say, okay, most blessed of patriarchs, take your point, Jefferson, a man of his time, in his time, but I still see him as a hypocrite because, I mean, even the things that we've been talking about, he was maybe a little too easy given the difference between American reality and what he wanted. Well, I mean, how do you argue against that?
You might ask a different question, and that is, how would somebody ever imagine a political system, a world based on the principle of equality? You have to lift yourself beyond your own circumstances. And this is what we call him to account for, because he could see something. He could imagine that nature enjoined and nature's God enjoined us to form governments based on affection, attachment, consent. And that vision, you say, well, it's impossible because he lived in the midst of slaves and it's not an equal society. But ask the question of how could he transcend his times? We hate him for what we love him for. That is, that he could say these things, and we say, you can't say these things, you didn't live them. But I think that's the challenge, and that's why our emphasis on enlightenment, the empire of the imagination, is critical. It's not to dismiss it, and that's where hypocrisy is a dismissal of that. It's to take it seriously.
Well, you write in, you point out that he wrote in Notes on Virginia, the whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. I mean, with that in mind, it was at the University of Virginia, the college and university that he founded, I mean, he wanted on his headstone, father of the University of Virginia, where there was a movement to remove or rethink whether or not a statue of Jefferson should be on the campus.
Well, you should know that tombstone is now at the University of Missouri, which is a nice connection with the current troubles.
Another place where Jefferson is in trouble as well.
Right.
Yeah, to me, that's an easier question. People often ask me about that. It depends on the person. I mean, you can't have the University of Virginia without Jefferson. So it would be sort of, bizarre if people thought that they could just sort of, disappear him from that particular campus.
And so what about the Missouri question? Or overall, I mean, let me broaden it, because I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation that on American campuses, there is this push now to rethink whether or not that these particular founding fathers should have such places of honor and respect on campuses.
No, we need to understand and engage our own history. That's all we're saying. And you can't have that history without the founders. Now, we don't worship the founders, but we know they're there, and we have to engage with them. If I could have reversed events and not had an American Revolution, I'd vote against the American Revolution, because it really institutionalized slavery and gave it a new lease on life. If you want to get into that kind of counterfactual argument, I'll go there with you. But you got this country, and it offers you opportunities to do things, to craft your own vision, to make things different, and give them their credit, and especially Jefferson. They saw those possibilities. They thought they were on the cusp of a new world that they could shape. And it's that exhilaration, that sense of possibility that we want to recapture, not the sordid realities of the fact that they drank so much and whipped slaves and whipped each other, and it was smelled bad, too. I mean, it's a nasty period. But in all that nastiness and all that sordidness, they could see beyond it. And can we see beyond what we have now? I mean, that's the rhetorical question I'd ask.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with all of that. You have to – their reality is belongs to us. We can't walk away from that any more than you can walk away from the country.
Wasn't it Jefferson himself who said the earth belongs to the living?
You
yes.
It's up to us.
Well, Annette Gordon Reed and Peter Onuf are co-authors of the new book, Most Blessed of the Patriarchs, Thomas Jefferson and the Empire of the Imagination. They will be speaking tonight at the Massachusetts Historical Society. We've got information about that at radioboston.org. Thank you both so very much for coming in today. It was a real pleasure to speak with you.
You bet.
We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.